but I hope you will find the Irish laws intriguing as I did. As you will see, our sources of information aren't nearly as good as we would like. But basically, there were essentially legal treatises at the time. This is something like the 7th or 8th century AD. None of them have survived in the original. All we have are things written maybe 600 years later, which copied chunks of the old treatises into them, and there are lots of stuff missing, and some of the copying might have been wrong. People make mistakes in copying manuscripts. We also have non-legal sources. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Tanes. They're sometimes referred to as the Irish sagas, although they're really quite unlike the Icelandic sagas. And among other things, they're in poetry, whereas the Icelandic sagas are prose. The Tanes are describing things quite a lot earlier. That the relevant history for Ireland is that it gets converted by St. Patrick, I think 6th century, 7th century, somewhere around there. The Tanes are describing the earlier pagan period. It's clear that when Patrick converts them, the result is various changes in the law, but the impression you get is not a new system, but rather imposing, you know, new things on an old system. So how you swear oaths is different. You don't swear in the presence of a druid with whatever the pagan oaths were. You swear by churchly kinds of oaths, and there are a variety of other rules, and there are now a new class of high-status people called bishops, and rules about monks and so forth and so on. But basically it looks like you probably have the older system with a bunch of changes. So we have some literary information that may help for that. There are some other surviving things, wisdom texts, books of sort of sayings of wisdom that you can deduce things from and so forth. But it's still pretty shaky, pretty interesting. And as you will see, part of what's interesting is that it looks as though parts of the law were even more private and decentralized in Iceland. Because in Iceland, as far as one can tell, before I collect the fine from you, I first have to get a court to say that you owe it to me. Or at least have to either that or have you agree to arbitration. Whereas as you'll see in the chapters you're reading, in Ireland, while there are courts and some things go through them, it looks as though if you owe me money, my normal procedure is to come onto your land with an appropriate set of witnesses, give you a notice that you owe me money and I'm going to seize some of your cattle to pay it, and you have a certain number of days in which to agree to arbitration, and eventually if you don't, I seize a bunch of your cattle with witnesses, drive them off your land, I'm responsible if I injure them in the process, put them in a suitable place, carefully protected, and if you still don't agree to arbitration, after a few days they start forfeiting to me, and I end up with cattle to the amount you owed me. So you'll read about it and see if that's a correct interpretation, but I think it is. So it looks like a system where sort of the ordinary basic way of enforcing your rights was to go do it yourself, in a procedure in which you're repeatedly proposing arbitration by some neutral party, but the person didn't really have the option of refusing that and keeping his property. In addition, there are other things which actually involve courts and judges and kings and so forth, and exactly how it divides, I'm not sure we know. Anyway, hopefully you'll find that stuff as interesting as I did. Let's go now back to the Jewish law, where unlike the Irish law, we have got the treatises written at the time. We've got whatever it is, I think 14 volumes of this. We've got the Mishnah, we have the Talmud, and so forth. Any reactions, by the way, to Mishnah and Talmud? I'm curious. I had sort of fairly strong reactions reading Maimonides after trying to read the other two, and I'm curious what people's feelings were. Could you make any sense out of what was going on in Talmud? Yes? No? Right, you all read a small chunk of Talmud as well as a larger chunk of Mishnah and lots of Maimonides. Any comments on it? Nobody? Yes? No? Yep?
Well, I read, I tried to read the portion of Mishnah that was on the low. I actually only found one portion, but what struck me is that it's sort of shorter. And,
yep.
You know, it's from that you can see how much they kind of fluffed it up or like taken a lot out of the very short.
Or interpret it. But you also remember that Maimonides' discussion of a subject may be based on more than one part of the Mishnah, since the Mishnah is less organized than Maimonides. So you'd have to look more carefully to know whether he's using several things. But no, you've clearly got all sorts of commentary after the Mishnah.
Yeah, I know. He's in the low section.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, right. So, all right, well, loans are an interesting subject. That's one which I don't think I've reread in the last week, so I only have my memory from last semester when I read it. Could you describe sort of what you learned about the law of loans, imagining you're temporarily a litigator in a Jewish court of 12th century? Precisely as insane as U.S. rules are on credit cards. A merchant is not permitted to charge you more for using a credit card, but he is permitted to give you a discount for cash. It's exactly the same silliness, in a sense, of making the form trump the substance, so to speak. I think it's federal. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right. It may be state. I don't really know. I just know that you see these rules being imposed. And I'm sure. I don't know. I think with a little effort, you could come up with other modern examples. But yeah, yes.
Well, when you're done, I thought something else is interesting about the borrowing.
About the borrowing, sure. Yeah.
Well, then you're not supposed to press the poor for the money,
right?
Unless they're not Jewish.
Yes.
And then you're supposed to press them. As
yes.
Positive.
Yes. Yeah.
And then. That was part of it, and then also about if a non-Jew owes you money, you can't say, well, I owe all my money outside the community. They won't take that at face value, because anyone could say that. So then you're supposed to pay people within the Jewish community first, and then if the person from outside the community presses him for the money and he's already given it up, then it's up to all of Israel to pay that person back.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Which makes me feel like you should just run a credit outside of Israel then, and you can get the state. So.
Maybe, but there is the state sort of overstates it, and I suspect you're going to be in very bad repute with your neighbors if you've in effect become an object of charity to pay off your debts, which seems to me is what's happening there. But yeah, on the question of not pressing people, though, there's a bunch of interesting stuff, because you've got essentially pawn arrangements. So you deposit something of value as the surety for your paying back the loan, and that's happening, you know, right through this. And what are the limits on that? If you've given me your blankets and your sheets and things, because you're a poor person in exchange for the loan, and what are my restrictions now? I've got to give them back to you at night. Basically, the rule seems to be that if you've put into pawn something which would be a serious problem for you not to have, and I think this is only supposed to be applying to poor people for whom this is a plausible situation, that there's something about, you know, not to press the widow for her. So I don't remember the exact, but there's some biblical text which is taken as meaning that I have to sort of give you back your blanket every night, and after I pick it up the next morning, and hopefully you eventually pay back the money I've lent you. But there's a bunch of stuff, yeah.
And also with the whole pressing request before, there's also like a corollary how the borrower can't be hiding his money. So if he has it, he has to return it.
Yes.
And there's this whole concept of if he doesn't return it, and you know he's hiding it, you issue a ban option for money, which I don't really part of that what that looks like. It doesn't seem like he gets kicked out of the city or anything.
It might be that other people refuse to do business with him or refuse to sell. I don't know either, but it could be something like other people won't sell to him or buy from him or, you know, let him marry their daughters or things of that sort. But I really don't know. But yeah, clearly one of the things running through both the loans and the sort of property stuff is this whole idea that when you borrow money, you're implicitly securing it with your land and property. Initially, I think only landed, and I think then, if I remember the sequence correctly, if I borrow money in the early period, you can levy against my landed property, but not against my movables. And later that reverses, though I think later it's that my movables will go up first and then my landed property will have enough movables. But one of the things that means is that all landed property at least is potentially encumbered. So that I sell you a field, you had better know whether or not I owe anybody any money. Because if I owe somebody money and I don't pay it, that field may forfeit to him even though you bought it. And you can then sue me, of course. But if I don't have any money, it won't do you any good to sue me. So there's a bunch of stuff which seems to involve that set of issues. And as I say, if I've got it right, there's a shift as to whether it's landed property or movables that you get a claim against. And it might be that what's going on is that in the early period, A, the landed property was most of what people had, and B, it's sort of hard to hide a field, whereas you can hide a bag of gold pretty easily. And then in the later period when in many places Jews weren't allowed to own land or weren't allowed to farm, you had a situation where the available property was all movable, so you had to base it on that instead. Yeah?
I didn't understand that part when they talk about, because whenever a person gives property as security without specifying a term for the loan, you can't remove the lender from the property until at least 12 months passed.
I guess. Do you happen to remember where that is? I've got the relevant volumes, but chapter 7 I'm looking, maybe different chapter systems. Is this Book of Civil Laws, the Book 13, which has got a section on hiring and then on borrowing and depositing? No. Creditor and debtor, loans and repayment. It's Treatise 3 in this. Oh, Chapter 7 of Treatise 3. Is that what it is? It starts out with usury, gauge of field without deduction, redemption of gauge in this translation, but of course the translations aren't all the same. Just a minute. See if I can make sense out of it. If a man lent money to his fellow who delivered to him a field as a gauge for a specified time or until he tendered the money, when the lender was to surrender the property, and the lender was taking all the profits, he may not be compelled to surrender the field without receiving anything on account of the loan, even if the profits equal the amount of the loan. Is that what it is? So I think what he's saying there, it's... If I've got it right, all that's saying is that I lend you some money, you put up your field as security. The deal is that I'm getting to use the field in the meantime, so it's not just pledged to me, but it's actually in my hands, as it were. And what he seems to be saying there, at least on this translation, is that the borrower can't say to me, look, you've made an amount of money from my field that's equal to the loan, so you're paid, give me back the field. And I'm not sure I clearly except in the case if the property belonged to orphans, and then he is compelled to surrender the property without receiving anything on account of the loan. This is chapter 7, at least in this translation. Is yours... How does it... All right. Anyway, yeah. Yes?
I didn't read much about it in our assigned portions, but there is reference to the whole loan forgiveness and that earlier.
Yes.
7. Is there much about that somewhere else today?
I think my guess is that you'll find more on that in the chapters that are mostly on, in the books that are most, volumes that are mostly on religious law, that I figured 3 volumes was probably enough for our purposes, but those 3 volumes are basically on secular issues, subject to the fact that, of course, everything has religious constraints, because it's all, in theory, based on Torah. But I think you will find in one of the other volumes a discussion of the laws of the Sabbath. And I still don't really understand that part very well, because how are you supposed to live if you're not allowed to cultivate your fields for a year? And yet that theoretically at least seems to be what the rule is saying. And everybody's doing the same year. I could imagine it if I do it 1 year and have crop rotation, but everybody doing the same year, we've got a real problem. So who am I going to buy food from unless we've stored a year's worth of food, which doesn't seem too likely. So I have not been able to make sense out of that business. Yeah. Yes.
And it seems like under Jewish law, the purpose of law is necessarily that they're universally applicable, that they apply to Jews and Jews alike. And it seems like that seems to be, maybe I'm wrong on Sharia, but that seems to be predominant.
That Sharia has different rules for non-Muslims and for Muslims.
There's a basic idea that if cultures adopted Sharia law, that their life would improve. It's the purpose of law to improve communities.
But in the Sharia, that, for example, non-Muslims can't be witnesses against Muslims in various cases.
But still the idea that non-Muslims are even than Muslims.
Well, but I think if you look at this, that the heathens living within the Jewish community have some legal rights, just not the same. And of course, the Sharia is sort of assuming that the Muslims are the rulers. I don't even remember whether Sharia discusses cases of Muslims who are in.
I don't have to get this. It seems like the theological foundation for, I guess, Christian law or the law that's adopted in society, not Christianity, is that. Purpose of law is to counter the depravity of people that were basically flawed, and that law serves the purpose of controlling basic instincts that have been.
I don't know. That is, if you think about medieval Europe, a lot of the law is coming out of Germanic legal systems that predate conversion to Christianity. You've got, typically in medieval Europe, you've got church law. Which applies to some things, but the ordinary law applying to, property and most of the stuff in here isn't coming from the church. It's either coming in some areas from Roman law, from Justinian, and that again is based on pre-Christian stuff, although by Justinian's time obviously they're all Christians, or it's based on stuff related to the Icelandic in the sense of Germanic, pre-Christian Germanic law, Anglo-Saxon in the case of England. I don't know. Yeah.
So to me is a different thing. I think it ties in with what you're saying, that I think both Islam and Christianity are both very heavy on the conversion side. And Judah is
not at all, that's
it's
right.
Not, it's kind of almost discouraging.
Yes.
So I think you have with Islamic and Christian law, you have more of an assumption on everybody is a member and everybody's law. There might be extra laws for other people, but they're because they want to be different.
Yeah.
But the base assumption is that they will be. Everybody's integrated. Whereas in Jewish law, you have this assumption that you have this isolated in-group that's kind of somewhat at odds with the world of the laws outside, and everyone's protected.
But which also has the problem that it's the world outside that's running things.
Yeah.
That presumably, some of this is of course being inherited back from when there was a real kingdom of Israel that was.
Which is interesting, right? Yeah. So we're starting off kind of with the opposite, where Christian and Islamic people were the minority.
Yeah, well, Islamic really aren't. That is, if you think about the history of Islam, the Muslims are in the minority for like 5 years in Mecca itself or so before the Hijra, and thereafter, where they are, they're the rulers, right? You've got.
It's still a conquest starting out. So
yes. Starting from a small base.
And I think very much from the idea that we're lacking something that the other monotheistic traditions of the West have.
Which is?
Or the Old Testament. I mean,
but the Muslims have the Old Testament.
Right, but I think
the Muslims have the advantage that they have the book of Muhammad.
But they subscribe to it because I think they saw the organized religion of Judaism and Christianity, and they wanted to have something like it, and wanted to bring their own people out of this perceived depravity of the monotheistic.
Of the polytheistic.
Cultures in which they conquered, they felt that Sharia was a gift, essentially, that they were giving to these people. So fundamentally, there was a belief that, that Sharia was universally applicable, that it would improve all communities.
Well, it was going to be, it was universally applicable under Muslim rule, it's just that it wasn't applicable identically to Muslims and to non-Muslims. And, of course, the non-Muslims, again, as in Christianity, have the option of converting to Islam, which is relatively easy, whereas converting to Judaism is hard, though not impossible. But, yeah, I don't know, I'm not sure I'm too strong on grand theories of why the law is what it is. I sort of satisfied trying to actually make sense of what each of the legal systems actually is. So anybody else who looked at the borrowing stuff and found interesting things in it? Because, and one of the things that is running through that is this whole issue that you were raising before of how you, of what arrangements for loans do or don't count as evading the prohibition on usury. And why the prohibition on usury exists in all of these cultures is so strong, I'm not sure. There's a modern book on Islam, Islam and Capitalism by Maxime Rodinson, and he argues that the prohibition on usury is a mistake, that he argues that the relevant passage in the Quran doesn't mean that, it means something else. But whether he's right, I have no idea. I don't know Arabic, obviously.
I think he's going to say not to press the poor for the debt.
Yep.
But once the person decides to press the poor, then they say, we're not merciful on the poor at that point. He needs to pay. You know?
I don't remember the passage, so.
Well, it's one of the early ones. It says when a lender demands payment of the loan.
First, which you remember which volume it's in?
Malachi 4, in the first chapter, first beginning.
Of which? We've got three volumes of
chapter
my...
Chapter 1.
Of which volume of Maimonides?
The borrowing one.
There isn't one on borrowing. There is the Book of Acquisitions, the Book of Torts, and the Book of Civil Laws. So this is some subpart of what...
3, chapter 1.
In what? 3, chapter 1 in which book?
If you go back to the beginning of your page...
Yes, I believe I named three different volumes of Maimonides. I think I don't give the Hebrew names of the...
It says loans, and then I have the three, and if you click on that link...
Just because there's the Book of Civil Laws, which is called... What's the Hebrew name for that?
I guess the book... 13.
Ah, volume 13. That's this one. That's Book of Civil Laws. And now, which book is it?
Chapter 1.
Book, Treatise 1, Hiring? Bailment?
I don't know. The lending one.
There's a credit, there's a borrowing and deposit. There's a hiring, then a borrowing and depositing, then a creditor and debtor.
Pertaining to lenders and borrowers.
Aha.
It's the very beginning. Chapter 1.
And what does chapter 1 start out with?
Well,
laws concerning hiring is the chapter 1 of volume 13.
To me, the first thing there says it's a positive commandment to lend money to the poor.
Ah, all right, just a minute. Let me see if I can figure out where that one is, because I remember that positive commandment, but I don't remember which of these that is in. One moment. Hiring... Borrowing and depositing, creditor and... Aha, that's Treatise 3, Creditor and Debtor, at least in this volume, I think. Let me see. That is... It is an affirmative commandment to lend to the poor of Israel. Right,
that's...
Right, and now what was the part... What?
You go down to number 4.
Number 4... When the creditor demands payment of the debt,
yeah,
even if he is rich and the debtor is in straits and exerting himself to earn his subsistence,
yeah,
there is to be no compassion in the administration of the law.
Right.
So that doesn't mean that the creditor isn't supposed to have compassion. That means that the creditor doesn't have compassion, the court's not to have compassion.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's funny that it says that the creditor should have compassion, but once he decides,
yes,
to press for the loan, then the law supports.
But wouldn't you say that there are lots of cases in our law in which the same thing is true? That if you, there are lots of cases where you say, look, the tenant of this apartment hasn't paid his rent for 3 months. Why hasn't he paid his rent for 3 months? He's unemployed, he's got this problem. If the landlord is a nice guy, the landlord is going to say, all right, you know, I'll put it off and, you know, wait till you have money. But nonetheless, the landlord does have the right to evict him if he doesn't pay his rent.
Right, but nowhere in our law does it say someone should press for the rent if the person's poor is in that state.
Yeah, I guess part of the problem, though, is that I think, as with Sharia, you've really got a combination of what we would think of as law and what we would think of as sort of ethics or morality in the same thing. So that there are, in a different chunk I was looking at today, there's the question of when people back out of their sales agreements. And he says, basically, here are the circumstances in which title is actually passed and you can't back out. If you've been paid, but the requirements for title passing haven't been met, you can back out and the other guy, and I guess if you've been paid, the other guy can't claim the property. But then the court is both to make you give the money back, because you've been paid, and pronounce a curse against you. And he gives the actual verbatim language of the curse that's to be used against you for, you know, as God punished the Egyptians, etc., he should punish you too, kind of thing. Then he says, well, if you've only got a verbal agreement and no money has been paid, now if you're an honest and honorable man, you will not back out of this. And I've got some phrases, but you don't actually get publicly cursed for backing out of it. So that in that case, and I think in other cases, he's really combining sort of moral statement on how you ought to act with legal statement on how you can't act. And that's
very different from our contract. You just kind of feel like to back out of a contract, there's no moral value either way on that. If it's better economically to back out of a contract, then you just say,
you don't think that people in business are going to think less of you if you gave a verbal agreement to something and then said, ha-ha, it's not in writing? Yeah?
No, I think even if it is in writing, they're not going to look bad on you. Mm-hmm. For instance, like, they have the line of cases where it's like, you've agreed to pay you rent to, like, Farmore, you know, and you're the owner of a mall. And then the agreement says, well, you're not going to rent to anyone else that sells pharmaceutical goods.
Right.
And then the next store comes in, it's willing to give you way more money. It says, well, I'll just buy their pharmaceutical goods. Like, as long as it's economically, you know.
But except that if you've got a, that is in terms of the actual U.S. law, if you do have a contract agreeing not to do something, then presumably he can sue you, right?
Right, he can enforce it, but there's no morals to it in either direction.
Yeah.
And the judges will only enforce it so much as, you know, they'll say that they're going to enforce it, but oftentimes it's just to put pressure for them to bargain down to what's economically viable for those.
Maybe. First, you shouldn't assume that Posner's description of what's economically efficient is a fully accurate description of what the law actually is, right? And certainly the sort of economic view would be that when a contract no longer provides net benefits, it's desirable to dissolve it. But I don't think that legally it's that simple. I mean, legally there are circumstances in which you can't or you can dissolve it. I mean, one way of putting it is that the reason for damage rules is so that you'll only dissolve it when it produces net benefits because you're bearing the costs of the other party. That's sort of the theory of expectation damage.
I just did
yes.
But they feel very, very bad about it. And I think the fact that they feel bad about it is a sign that we have to do morally not endorse breach of contract. Although the bank, you know, if you do an economic analysis of it, well, the lender has already sold their mortgage on and on, they're not morally anymore.
Well, there's somebody out there, though, who owns the mortgage.
Right, but it's kind of, you know, both sides have came to the bargaining table with something to get, and, you know, everybody...
And it may well be a non-recourse mortgage, in which case you have a perfect right to walk out of it as long as you're willing to give away the house.
Exactly. And so economically speaking, the closer view, I think there should be no moral conflict, but people feel bad about it.
But might it not be desirable that people feel bad about it, in the sense that it makes it easier to borrow money if you know that the other person won't take advantage of opportunities to...
I'm not saying that there's not a place for morality.
Yes.
I think that's exactly...
It's not, but it's not law. But in this, in any case, the point seems to me to be that the court is not to say we will bias the law in favor of, we will bias our interpretation of the law in favor of the poor person. After all, one way of putting it is that if the court does that, they're not giving away their property, they're giving away the lender's property. And, you know, it's always a little suspicious when you show how virtuous you are by giving away someone else's property, whereas the lender, in not pressing the person, is doing it with his own property. But they then also state what are the limits of it. The creditor may not levy upon the garments of the debtor's wife and children, nor upon the dyed garments which were dyed for them, although they have not yet worn them, nor upon the new shoes which were purchased for them, and so forth. This is the one which one of you were just citing here just after this. If the debtor has movables or landed property, but there are bonds outstanding against him in the hands of heathen creditors. Now, within the Israelite community, if he has property but he has debts against it, then you can't seize that property because there's a lien on it. And he says, all my property is obligated to the heathen creditor. And if the Israelites will levy upon him for their debts, the heathen creditors will imprison me for theirs and I will be a captive. No heed is to be paid to his plea. Let the Israelite creditors levy upon the property. And if the heathen creditors should come and imprison the debtor, it would then be incumbent upon all Israel to redeem him. So my teachers have ruled. So he's... That's right. So I presume one of the things that's going on, I assume, is we don't know whether he really owes all that money to the heathen lenders. He obviously has an incentive to say he does, so he won't take his land. Therefore, take the land. If it's true and the Gentile authorities lock him up, now it's our duty to do something to get him out. But so it's not clear to me that it would really make a whole lot of sense to follow the strategy you were describing before of getting yourself indebted in order that you could be locked in an unpleasant prison and wait in the hopes that eventually some of your fellow Israelites will redeem you. But an exemption from levy of a portion of his property is made for the debtor. Just as such an exemption is made for the person who has taken a vow of valuation. I don't know what that is. The debtor is told to bring all the movables he possesses without leaving even a single needle. And he's given food for 30 days and such clothing as is suitable for him for 12 months. But he may not don silk clothes or a gilded headdress. You see, it's, you know, what do you do when you're going to go bankrupt in the U.S.? You buy a really expensive house in Florida because in Florida, your home is not subject to bankruptcy. So if they haven't sensibly put this in, what do you do when you are going to go bankrupt because you can't pay your loans? You buy the most expensive clothing you can. And you say, well, look, I'm entitled to clothes for 12 months, and, you know, this happens to be my clothes for the next 12 months. No, that's a no-no. And if he does, it is to be removed from him, and he's to be given instead suitable clothes for 12 months. The debtor is also to be allowed a couch on which to sit and bed and bedding suitable for him on which to sleep. Or, if he's a poor man, a bed and a straw mattress on which to sleep. But such articles are not to be allowed for his wife or children, although he is obligated to support them. And so forth. If he is a craftsman, he is to be allowed two tools of each kind, such as if he is a carpenter, two adzes and two saws. So you can see that the sort of part of the intent is to not to beggar him, to make sure he still has the tools to earn a living, that he's not going to starve to death in the next month at least, and hopefully in that month he can earn some more money and so forth. But it is interesting because that really does amount to their version of bankruptcy law. It hadn't occurred to me, but that's what they're doing. What are the rules under our bankruptcy law? Anybody know? Aside from your house, it's state law. But do you know in any particular state when you go bankrupt, is there a specified amount you're allowed to keep?
Well, I know in Florida, I think here they can take like your clothes and they can take everything, but in Florida they can't. You know, like what OJ moved to Florida.
I thought it was the house was the specific one I had seen. That in Florida they couldn't take your house.
Right. And they can't take, like, all your possessions in Florida.
But you don't know what the limits are in other states. Well, I don't know if it's all your... What?
I don't think they can do much here. I think you can be, like, under $5,000 for the assets.
Is that...
Yeah. I know that, like, you file, like, a chapter 13 or chapter 11 or whatever. You go to the court and they work out a payment schedule for your debt. And after, you don't get credit for 7 years. And after 7 years, your debt is expired. They can't take your house or your car or your clothes or anything like that. They can definitely, like, ask if you have a lot of liquid assets, you can
But if you have, you're saying they can't seize your car for that? That's interesting. It's true. If anybody's curious, you could look up the what California law is and see just where, what the rules are.
Well, if you think about it, right? They want you to work, they'll kind of get you in the car.
They could take your car. There are buses, you know. Yes, well, you may know a higher class of bankrupt than. I assume, but I know nothing about bankruptcy law. Fortunately, I have not had to study that subject for any practical purpose. So, other things that people observed on this whole sort of debtor bankruptcy, that set of rules, things. No. All right. What else? What do we have? Somebody else who sort of saw neat things or interesting things in the part that he or she read and feels like talking about. Yep.
Well, I listened to the inheritance portion.
Inheritance, yep.
Yeah.
And?
So I thought it was interesting that firstborn gets a double portion.
Yes. Right. No, that's that part is interesting, and I no longer remember, other than there were a variety of sort of constraints to that rule. I don't remember, how much testamentary freedom do you have? To what extent can you write a will deciding who gets your stuff? Because there's some, I think, but not.
I just know that. Sorry, I don't have it in front of you, but yep. I just started taking notes. In the Mishnah, is that a man just has to say, "This is my son; he may believe," and then his son could receive it. But then, if it was, I guess if it was, is that if it was attached to his when he was dead to his thigh, then I don't know
if the property was, or
yeah,
the
like
statement.
Of Mishnah.
Yeah, I actually now own a copy of the Mishnah, but I didn't bring it in with me because it's this thick. Whoever is prior in the order of inheritance, his issue is also prior, so that means that presumably the son of your no longer alive first son. What? Yeah, I think if I've got it right that that it does go, I know it's, if prosterpes is the right term, but basically, if I'm the eldest son and I die, my son gets the double inheritance, I think. Yes, that's correct. And I think the daughters, if I remember, have some kind of a claim for enough to pay their dowries or to support them, or, and the wife, as I remember, has some kind of a claim, the widow, for stuff to support her. And she gets her ketchup back, doesn't she? When he dies, or when she... There's this.
I know that the man inherits from his mom and his wife.
Right. Yes. The daughter is prior to her father's father, however, so it goes down through the female line before it goes up even through the male line. If a man died leaving a daughter and a son's daughter, nay, even a son's daughter's daughter's daughter, to the end of many generations, the latter is prior and shall inherit everything, and the decedent's daughter shall have anything. So as long as... So it go, it went first to the son rather than the daughter. He died. Well, he died, and all he's got is a daughter. Got to go to the daughter. She died, and all she has is a daughter. Got to go to the daughter, and so forth. So presumably one... Anyway, it's a fairly detailed discussion of how that works.
Do you know who, in the mission I noticed, they used as an example, it was a lot to have, or it was a lot to have.
I don't know.
That is,
no, I don't. But Google probably does.
Yes.
Only it's not Google, right? It's Topeka today, I think. Isn't that right? I think they decided to... This is April 1st. And apparently the city of Topeka temporarily renamed itself Google in an attempt to get Google's high-speed internet experiment there. And so Google has responded for the purposes of April 1st by renaming Google Topeka. I'm just going to look where it says the firstborn. The firstborn son who was born after his father's death does not take a double portion. But wait a minute. If he's the firstborn son after his father's death, then there aren't any other sons, right? He's born posthumously. I guess it could be, because there could be more than one wife. That's right. It's a polygynous society. So you could imagine that there are two sons, both born posthumously to different mothers. Or even twins, which, I don't know, do they count the one who comes out first as firstborn? I bet they do. I think, isn't that a... that? I think in the Bible there's this, there is a case of twins where it matters who came out first. Pretty sure that's right. But if his forehead emerged in his father's lifetime, even though his whole head did not emerge into the world, until after his father's death, he takes a double portion. Now this is weird. A firstborn who was operated upon by section and found to be a male does not take a double portion. And a plain son who was similarly operated upon and discovered to be a male does not cause a diminution in the primogeniture portion. For it is written, and they have borne him sons, he must be a son from the moment of his birth. So are they talking about hermaphrodites? Sounds like it. Somewhere else, there's a discussion, I don't remember if it's in Maimonides or Mishnah, of two different categories of ambiguous gender. One of which is clearly hermaphrodites, and the other seems to be people who are born, I don't know what, if it's some particular birth defect in that area at the time, but with some kind of an obstruction so that you can't tell if they're male or female. I don't know if it's sort of flesh in front of the genitals or something. It wasn't at all clear what was going on, except that he seemed to assume people knew what it was. And so that may be part of found to be a male and so forth. That may be what the plain son is. I'm not sure. Tum-tum, that's the term for the tum-tum, I think, if I remember correctly, is not the hermaphrodite, but is the other one, which I'm not sure I understand, who was later operated upon and found to be a male, right? So, but anyway.
Well, another thing that I find interesting is that it explained why a man inherits from his mom and wife. And it said it's because the Torah doesn't want property to go from tribe to tribe, so you want to keep it within the tribe.
But there are clearly a bunch of ambiguous cases in which there's a dispute about who was the firstborn son. And you could see, especially with twins, but also, you know, if they were born fairly close together by different mothers, or even if it's been for a while. If the father left a cow which was hired out for hire or on shares, or was grazing in the pasture ground, and after the father's death the cow bore young, the firstborn takes the double portion in the cow and her offspring. I just sort of struck by the elaborate detail in which he's trying to sort of cover all of his possible things. Do people know, by the way, something which shows up a number of places, including here, is Levitical marriage. Do people know what that's about? Levira, I guess is the term. There is a prohibition, and the real discussion is probably in one of the volumes we're not reading, but there's a rule which says that if a man dies, I think it's without sons, his brother is to marry his widow and then produce a son who will be considered to be the son of the original husband for legal purposes. And it looks as though this is initially mandatory on both of them, I think. And then there is a procedure is developed by which the woman can sort of ceremonially, I think she hits him with a slipper or something like that, but she does something in which she is saying, you know, my husband's brother refuses to do his duty by his brother and won't marry me, so I'm not married to him. And then she's free to go marry somebody else. And I'm not sure. I think maybe it's not incumbent upon the brother. Maybe originally it was that the widow had to marry the brother if he would have her, and he was supposed to marry her, and that then this was a procedure by which the widow could get out of it on her initiative as well as the brother on his. But anyway, it sort of keeps showing up in various bits and pieces in the law. So he who marries his brother's wife by liberatical, however you pronounce it, marriage, inherits all of his brother's vested property. But with respect to the property which the deceased brother had in expectancy, he is like all the other brothers, since Scripture has called him firstborn, and so forth, and so on, and so on, and so forth. So it goes into all sorts of complicated stuff where this comes in.
Do we know whether historically, like, birthdays were
legit? I just don't know.
Because we know of cultures where they don't really pay attention.
Yes.
If you have two brothers who are similar in age, and one is capable and one is not.
Yeah. Decide that the more capable one was first born. Yeah, and I think there are a variety of things here which seem to be a matter of declarations. If a man who was reputed to be another man's brother or his uncle's son, and the other man said, he is not my brother or he is not my uncle's son, he is not to be believed. Why is he not to be believed? What's the obvious suspicion? He doesn't want to share his inheritance. Right? If my father dies and I and my brother are supposed to split it, I say, no, he's not my brother. He just pretends to be my brother. He's not really related at all. I get all the inheritance. So you're not going to believe me when I say that. On the other hand, but if he said with respect to a man who is reputed to be his son, he is not my son, he is believed, and that man shall not inherit him. Now, presumably part of this is the question of legitimacy, that he may mean, I'm pretty sure he's actually so-and-so's son by my wife. Others might be cases where, you know, they moved into the area from somewhere else and no one else knew, and it was just one person's word against another. But presumably part of the argument, here we are. Just a minute. And it seems to me that even if the son had children, although with respect to pedigree, the father is not believed when he says, he is not my son, and the son is not established by the mouth of the father to be the issue of an adulterous union, the father is believed with respect to inheritance. So, if I read that correctly, the father can't in general declare his son to be illegitimate, but he can disinherit him by saying he's not his son. I think that's what it's saying. And so forth and so on. If while passing through the custom house, a man said, this is my son, and thereafter he retracted and said, this is my bondman, that is his slave, he is believed. Because when he said, he is my son, it was only for the purpose of avoiding the payment of duty. If he said in the custom house, he is my bondman, and then retracted and said, he is my son, he is not believed. Right, so we understand that you'll tell lies in order to avoid taxes, and that's sort of taken for granted, that you would never tell a lie that resulted in paying more taxes, and therefore we don't believe you when you change your word on that, and so forth. And if a man had a bondwoman, that is a slave, and he got a son by her and was behaving toward him in the manner in which one behaves towards his sons, or said, he is my son and his mother has been emancipated, the son shall inherit him. If the father was a scholar or a worthy man of proven strictness in the observance of the religious precepts, then we'll believe him. Nevertheless, the son may not marry an Israelite woman unless he produces proof that his mother was emancipated before she gave birth to him, since the mother was reputed to be a bondwoman. But if the father was one of the common people, and needless to say, if he was one of those who abandoned themselves in such things, the son is presumed to be a bondman in every respect, and his brothers by his father may sell him. And if his father left no other son by him, but him, his father's wife is subject to the law of levirical marriage, and so forth. And there are various distinctions, and this is one of the ones where he cites that there's one authority who disagrees with him. So you can see it makes quite a lot of difference, because are you a slave who your brothers can sell, or are you one of the brothers who's got the right to share in the inheritance, and they may have an opinion on that that's different than yours. And so you've got to prove that your father, who said you were his son and who said he had emancipated your mother, is really a worthy man and ideally a scholar, because scholars are the most worthy of all men, as Maimonides knows, and then you're home free. Anyway, I just find sort of reading this rather fun and bizarre. Other things that struck people? I've got some notes of my own if I run out of yours, but... All right, I think I've more or less worked out the law of sales. Did anybody do the law of sales? No. And the basic rule seems to be that you can't acquire title just by words. So if I say I sell it to you, and you say, great, I buy it, I'll pay you $100 for it, it's still mine. Which matters, because it means that if between then and the time we actually do some further actions towards implementing this agreement, if it gets stolen, I'm the one who loses it, not you. All right? So, and the same thing applies to gifts. That what's the rule in the U.S.? If I say to my friend, I'm giving you that car, it's yours now, does he have any claim to it if I haven't actually made out the title? No. So similar kind of rule.
You need a token at least.
What?
You need the handover of a token of that, like.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's getting close to the Jewish law, because the Jewish law says that immovable property, land, you don't need witnesses, but you do need an act. And there are basically three kinds of acts that will transfer land. One of them is money payment. If I pay you for the land, unless we're in a place where it's customary to always have deeds for a land, deed distinguishes. But as long as that isn't the local custom, I give you the land is now mine. By a deed, and the rule there is that if the land is unproductive property, if it's a field that you're getting rid of because it isn't growing anything, then you can simply write out a deed to me and it's mine, even with no payment. Whereas productive property, presumably it's implausible that you would give it to me for free, so for productive property requires the sum of a deed and money. And finally, and most interestingly, as sort of gets into the other things, you can transfer land by act of possession. So basically, an act of possession is something you do to the land in the presence of the previous owner, presumably without his objecting, which somehow improves it. And Maimonides goes through a wide variety of things you might do. You might remove a stone that was impeding a water course that let water into the land. You might put in a stone that blocked something. You might strengthen a fence that was too low. You can even, I think for a house as I remember, lock it and then unlock it. And the locking protected it, so you've done something to improve it, now you unlock because you want to be able to go in. But basically a whole bunch of things which involve acting as if you were the owner of the land, in effect, and doing it with the owner there. Or alternatively, if the owner isn't there, but if the owner told you to, if the owner says, go take possession and acquire. And a lot of these things, you have the feeling that the exact words matter. Yep.
I hear a story about this church that's in Jerusalem that's been owned by Muslims, Christians, and Jews at one point. And the Druids there keep the keys to it for all three of them, so that none of them would go in and improve it and then claim title to it.
That's interesting, yeah. How do they find Druids? Druids or Druze?
Yeah, there you go.
Druze.
Yeah, there's someone, yeah.
That's more plausible. Druids are in short supply in Jerusalem. But maybe nowadays there are a few modern ones. So, and there are detailed rules about what things do or don't count as taking possession. And if you're buying 10 fields, even if they're not connected, as long as you take possession of one of them, you own all 10. It sort of is contagious, as it were. Also, heathens can't get property just by taking possession of it with permission and so forth. They've got to use the deed plus money version. That's for immovable property. That's for land. And same rules work for lease, that I can't lease the land by just making a verbal agreement, but I can lease it by giving you money if custom permits that, or money plus a deed, or the agreement plus my using the land in your business, thus showing that I've got it leased. A Canaanite slave, you will notice if we get to the discussion of slaves, that there are two categories of slaves, Israelite slaves and Canaanite slaves, where I think Canaanite slaves are all non-Israeli, or non-Jewish slaves, although they use the term Canaanite. And a Canaanite slave, oddly enough, is acquired the same way as land. And there are various places in the law where they sort of mention, you know, these rules apply to land and to Canaanite slaves. And I don't know why, but there must be some biblical text that makes it that leads to that conclusion. And so how do you do the equivalent of improving a Canaanite slave? He does something for the new master of the sort slaves do. He, you know, combs his hair or cooks him dinner or does some activity showing that he's being used as a slave by his new master. You can also do it by lifting up your slave. This is going to come in later with cattle, because cattle can be, if you're capable of doing it, you can acquire property rights by lifting them up. Or seizing the slave by force, because that's, after all, how you originally got your Canaanite slaves, presumably. They were defeated in battle and seized by force and enslaved. So all of those things are legitimate. A slave who is a minor can also be acquired in the same way as cattle, which he goes into later. Cattle, of course, are not real estate. They're movables. And they are acquired by an act of possession. And an act of possession for cattle is either drawing them to you, as leading the the cow along somewhere, or lifting it up, which probably works better for very small cattle, for sheep maybe, but not very well for bulls unless you're a very strong person. The interesting thing is that the requirement that you take possession of movables is a requirement imposed by the rabbis in contradiction to the original biblical law. That the biblical rule apparently was that you could get cattle and other movables by paying for them, by money. That's what, I'll be going through the whole thing, but what it looks like is you've got a biblical rule, the sages then make a further rule that restricts it, and people then work around to get back to the first place by sort of workarounds in the second set of rules. But anyway, to start with, the position of the sages is that you can only get possession of movables by lifting them, or if lifting them isn't practical, by drawing them, by pulling them, or acting like the master. I think riding a horse would count if I've got it right. And the interesting example, he says, suppose you've got a bundle of firewood, and the bundle is too heavy to lift. Can you get position by just pulling possession, get ownership by pulling along? No, you can't. Because it is not a thing that can't be lifted, because you could have always untied the bundle and lifted the pieces one at a time. On the other hand, a bundle of pepper or nuts, if you untied the bundle, they'd be scattered all over the road, you'd lose some of them, that clearly isn't a practical option, so that one, if it's too heavy to lift, you can pull. Anyway, I like that bit. But if the title has not, since the title can't be obtained by money, that means that if I've paid you, but I haven't drawn it, I haven't lifted it or pulled it, then you can still cancel the contract. Now, of course, you're a bad person if you do that. That gets to the business later on about having me being publicly cursed for pulling out of it. But legally speaking, you can do it. And getting back to our stuff on Chinese law, Maimonides believes that the reason that the sages said that you didn't get ownership by just paying for it was to keep the legal ownership with the person who had possession, because that was the person who could control the property and protect it. So that if we say, you've paid me the property, but it's still in my warehouse, and by the way, a thief came by and stole it, if the doctrine was, as the biblical rule apparently was, that you paid the money, it's yours, so it was stolen from my warehouse, but you bear the loss and I keep the money. And the sages said, that's not a good rule. We are going to follow the rule of the Chinese in Taiwan, which we have mysteriously discovered in some way by reading this book published in the 20th century. The rule we're going to impose is it doesn't become yours until you've in some actual or symbolic sense taken possession of it. And that therefore the guy who sold it to you is going to bear the loss if in his possession it gets damaged or stolen. That's at least Maimonides' view of what's going on. But then, as you'll see, they then devise various ways in which you can in fact get ownership of stuff without taking possession of it, which is somebody does. And the sort of first step in that direction is, suppose you have land and then you've got movable things on the land, like cattle or firewood or something of that sort. In that case, when you get title to the land, you also get title to the movables that are on the land. Seems reasonable enough. But notice that you can get title to the land by just paying money without taking possession of anything. Remember, that was one of the three ways of getting title to the land. So we now have a way in which we can get title to movables by paying money and not taking possession. All we've got to do is to make sure the movables are sitting on a piece of land, and we're going to buy that piece of land without actually taking possession. And furthermore, it goes even further, because the movables don't really have to be on the land. If we use the right verbal formula, which Maimonides helpfully gives us, you can say, in effect, I am giving you possession of the land and the following movables, which I am associating with land, even though they happen to be sitting 3 miles away. And at that point, we now have an even broader way in which you can transfer movables by a payment of money without it actually ever getting them into your hands, just the way the sages are trying to keep you from doing. Right? Furthermore, since you can do it by associating with the land, there's no limit on how small the piece of land is. So therefore, if I want to transfer my automobile to you, what do? I say, well, I'm going to transfer to you my automobile plus 1 square foot of my driveway. May or may not have a tire on it. I'm not sure at the moment. And I can transfer the square foot of the driveway to you for an exorbitant $30,000. But by the way, the car goes with it, and that's what you're really paying $30,000 for it. Maybe I'll buy the square foot of the driveway back to you for 10 cents afterwards. So we now have one mechanism by which, having just made a few centuries earlier, made a rule saying that you can't become the owner of, get title to property without physically taking possession of it in some sense. We've just found a way of doing so. And Maimonides then has an elaborate discussion of all of this lifting and drawing stuff. Where does it have to happen to count? When does it count? And so forth, which I'm going to ignore. But there's then another rule which provides a second and even more useful loophole. And that rule is that movables acquire each other. And what does that mean? It means that if I am trading my glasses for your book, once you've taken possession of the glasses, I own the book. I have title to the book, even if I didn't take possession of that. Can you see where that is leading? How we have now found a loophole that doesn't even require any land. So we now have what is referred to as kinyon, which is where it comes from, which is symbolic barter. And kinyon is, I want to sell you my load of spices, which are on the backs of camels 300 miles from here, and you can't draw them, but that's all right. I've got a handkerchief. You've got a handkerchief. You're going to buy my spices with your handkerchief. You're also going to pay me some money, but money doesn't count, right? You can't acquire movables with money. So you're going to give me your handkerchief in exchange for my spices. I take the handkerchief into my hand. I've now drawn it. It's fine. Now I have good title to that handkerchief. You can have it back. I don't really want it. I have good title to this handkerchief. Since I have good title to the handkerchief, you have good title to what the handkerchief was exchanged for, so you now own those sacks of spices on the backs of camels 300 miles away. Right? And this is the procedure called kinyon, which ends up getting used as the sort of symbolic gesture for all sorts of, now this is really a deal kinds of transactions. And Maimonides actually mentions that in addition to being used for sales where it actually works, that there are a bunch of other transactions which didn't require drawing in the first place and therefore which could have been done just fine for money, but people do kinyon for them too, because I think of kinyon as sort of the way you symbolize the transaction happening. On the other hand, kinyon cannot be used to do things such as making a future commitment binding. One of the other things you see running through some of this is a generally negative attitude to things like futures markets. That the general view is, I can't transfer ownership of something until it exists. And therefore, there are ways around it, there are ways around everything, but there are sort of restrictions on my saying, give me $500 now, and when next year's crop comes in, you can have next year's crop for my West Field. That's not an easy contract to make binding under Jewish law, and in particular, I can't make it binding by Kenyan. I can't say, you give me a handkerchief and some money, and remember, money doesn't count for these things, and I will give you the right to whatever harvest comes from my West Field next year. That's not legitimate, because I couldn't transfer title to that harvest, because that harvest isn't there to be transferred. That's at least the view they seem to be taking. But there's a term, osmocta, which is related to that, and that's a future transfer conditioned on a future event. So if I say, I will give you the field if you marry my daughter who's too young to be married at this point, that's osmocta and is not a binding contract. Unless, and I'll leave out the unless. On the other hand, I can say, I will give you my field now conditional on your marrying my daughter next year. So if you marry my daughter next year, then you've owned the field from now on. But if you don't, then you never own the field. And that seems sort of screwy, too. But that one, since I'm actually giving you something now rather than a future right, does count as a legitimate transaction, at least according to Maimonides. And let me find page 42 of this, he describes a workaround figured out by the Spanish sages for getting around some of this. Here we are. So again, asmachta is transactions for future performance or future things. When the sages of Spain wished to validate a transfer by asmachta, they made the following arrangement. They made the first party obligate himself by a kinyan that he owed another party 100 dinar. After he thus obligated himself, they made the second party bind himself by a kinyan that as long as certain conditions should obtain, or if the first party should perform a certain act, he, the second party, would remit the obligation as of now. So first I say, I agree I owe you 200 dinar. Then you say, I agree that I won't demand the 200 dinar of you, provided that next year you marry my daughter. Or whatever the future condition is. And if the condition should not obtain, then I'll demand the money, the 200 dinar. And it doesn't have to be an act you take. It could also be it's a conditional payment, like a bet or something, where I'm saying, if you, I'll pay you, I'll give you this land, provided that Spain doesn't go to war next year. But if Spain does go to war next year, the condition doesn't apply. So if you want the land, so whether or not you want the land, you will owe me the 200 dinar that you promised to pay me. And I then said I wouldn't collect if. And so forth. So it's just interesting to me, at least, as the elaborate kinds of ways in which people find ways around the restrictions that they've written or deduced about what people are allowed to do. I mentioned before the question of disguised usury in these things, but again, this is one of the ones where, you know, you give with one hand and take away with another, maybe the other way around. But the rule is that if I sell you my land, and the condition I set on the sale is that you agree that when I have the money, I need the money right now. So when I've got the money, you'll sell the land back to me for the same price. Right? That's fine. You can make that agreement. If, however, we make that agreement, then you can't collect the income from the land in the meanwhile. Because if you were collecting income from the land, the transaction was really a loan. Right? It's really as if you would lend me the price of the land, and I put up the land as security, and I'm entitled to have the land back as soon as I pay off the debt. Well, if we do that and you get to collect the income from the land, then you're getting paid interest on your loan, and that's a violation of the will of the security. On the other hand, if I sell you my land, and I don't put any conditions on it, but you just happen voluntarily to say, and by the way, I promise that if you come up with the money in the next 5 years, I'll sell you the land back at the same price. Now you can collect the income from the land in the meanwhile. Because now it wasn't that it was made as a loan, it was just that you happened out of the goodness of your heart to agree to sell me back the land if I wanted it. So, again, it seems a little bizarre. Trying to think what else there is. There are a bunch of... Well, let me say just a little bit about slaves, so that I have time to cover everything. Where do you get Israelite slaves from? And the basic answer is that if you are convicted of theft and don't have the money to pay to make good what you stole, the court may sell you. And if they do that, they are selling you for 6 years, and on the seventh you're free. So it's really indentured servitude rather than strictly speaking slavery. Alternatively, you can sell yourself, and you're only allowed to sell yourself if you're in desperate circumstances, basically. And nobody can sell a woman, Israelite woman, with an exception I'll come to in a minute. But for the first approximation, only men can be sold for theft. That's true, in fact. And only men, in fact, it's true both that only men can sell themselves and that only men can be sold for as a punishment for theft. The only situation in which female Israelites get sold is that a girl before puberty can be sold by her father if he is desperate, if he's starving to death, more or less. But she becomes free when she shows the first signs of puberty. So that's an even shorter, presumably indentured servitude of a girl. And there's, I think, a strong suggestion in a number of these things that they're worried about sexual implications of slavery. So that, for example, an Israelite woman may not own a male slave. because it might lead suspicion. I don't know how he puts it, but I think it's pretty clear because she might be sleeping with him. She can presumably own female slaves, as I read it. The rules for Israelite slaves, there are all sorts of rules for Israelite slaves. It's a really soft birth. Israelite slaves may not be worked with rigor, may not be put to low status, humiliating sort of occupations, ought to be given the same food, clothes, and housing as his master. If he sells himself, he can contract when he sells himself for how many years he's selling himself for. And that can be for more than 6 years. He's free if the Jubilee happens, but that's only every 50 years or 49 years or something. At any point, if he's got money, he can buy himself back for a proportion of his price corresponding to the proportion of the length of time he sold himself is still undone. So if he sold himself for 10 years, he's worked for 5 years, he can buy himself back for half price. If his value goes up, if he becomes stronger and healthier and more skilled, he can still buy himself back at his original sales price. If his value goes down, he gets sick and weak, he can now buy himself back at the appropriate proportion of his current value. So it's the lower, either his original value or his current value, that's the price he buys himself back with. There are some other rules I'm not going to go into, but the real kicker is that all of these rules that I've just described only apply when the law of the Jubilee applies, and the law of the Jubilee, I think, only starts applying after we rebuild the temple, which isn't going to happen anytime soon. So this is an elaborate set of rules, which presumably in theory applied in the ancient days, which Maimonides may think are going to apply again just as soon as the Messiah shows up, but which, as far as I can tell, don't really describe the rules with regard to Israelite slaves at the time of Maimonides. All right, we're out of time. I hope that all of you in your leisure time will peruse Maimonides and learn wisdom therefrom. But our next subject is going to be Irish law, and I only wish we had a Maimonides equivalent for Irish law, but we don't.